We're continuing our study in the life of Christ. We're picking back up, get all of our electronics sorted out here. We'll be in John chapter 17 just a moment. We're finishing up this section that John details for us, the synoptic gospels. Matthew, Mark, and Luke do not include these, and as we mentioned last time, we see this kind of as John's way of supplementing and telling us what Jesus said from the time of the upper room to the time of his prayers in Gethsemane. Chapter 17 of John, I would make an assumption that it's possibly in the garden. We're not actually told, but there is a shift there from John 16 to John 17, where he goes from clearly discussing things and talking to his disciples and apostles to his prayer to the Father. So whether or not this is actually, and we'll see in a minute from Matthew and Mark's account, Luke's account, that he goes and talks to the Father in the garden, whether this is part of that or not, we're not exactly sure. But he does have some interesting prayers here. Praise to be glorified. We're not going to spend a lot of time going through the detail of these, but we do want to mention them because they are important. He prays for his disciples. Picking up in verse 12, says, "While I was with them in the world, I kept them in your name. Those whom you gave me I have kept, and none of them is lost except the son of perdition, that the scripture might be fulfilled." Verse 16, it says, "They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth." So he asks his Father for these that have followed him. He turns his attention then to those who are going to come later. Verse 20 says, "I do not pray for these alone, but also for those who will believe in me through their word." So who's that? That's us. So Jesus here, before he is glorified, before he goes to the cross, has mindful even those that are going to come later. He prays for all the believers. He prays for unity. Just to mention on this, we've talked about the authority of the scriptures and all here recently. It's amazing, though, how many people reject that, and it's interesting to see how this was on his mind that he mentions in these prayers that they will be united. I think by some, depending on how, which way you try and divide things, there's over 38,000 different denominations in the world. And so that prayer has gone quite unfulfilled. And I just put in the slides and wanted to talk a minute. How do we fulfill this prayer that Jesus had? How in the world can we go about being united? Okay. What else? Very good. I just come up with a couple of things on how we unite. First of all, being in the Word. If we have this as a standard, if we're all looking to it instead of a man's ideas, then there's the potential there for being united. Recognizing the differences of opinion that we have, and the only way we can understand what's opinion, what's not opinion, is to understand the Word. So I just put those in there because it came to mind that one of Jesus's, really when you think about his last prayers on earth, was that we would be united. Any other questions, comments on that section before we move on? Just again, I wanted to kind of quickly survey those few chapters in John. Brad? Yes. Oh, okay. All right, so picking up with the narrative here, we see that we are in Gethsemane. If we go over, we're going to use Matthew chapter 26. Let me get there myself. And so we see now the Synoptic Gospels picking up where John leaves off there in the Garden of Gethsemane. And he tells his disciples to stay in a certain place, and he goes and prays. And he says that he takes Peter, and James, and John, and goes a little further and becomes very sorrowful. And what is Jesus' prayer at this time? What is he asking God for? Yeah, we have to remember, Jesus went willingly to the cross, but this was going to be a, as we see as we read through this narrative and this account, that this was going to be a very hard thing to do. And I think it's perfectly understandable that Jesus, the man who was all man and all God, would have some concern about, as he said, the cup that he is going to have to drink. And so if there was any other way for this to be accomplished. But even after he makes this request, what's the closing line there? Okay, not my will, but what you will to be done. And so this occurs then three times that we have recorded here. Each time he comes to his disciples who have fallen asleep. He goes back each time and prays this again and for a third time again making the same request, but still always ending with that, you know, but not as I will, but as you will. And Luke adds for us that an angel attended him, that he was under such stress at this time that his sweat was as great drops of blood. Some have interpreted that to be blood, but I don't know that we can interpret it that way. It just says that his sweat was as great drops of blood. So we can maybe get a picture here of that anxiety, of that stress that he was going through at that time. He comes back to his disciples, and they're still sleeping, resting. But he says, this is the end. Verse 46, rise, let us be going, see my betrayer is at hand. And so the scene shifts then for Judas coming with a great multitude. We know that these were some troops dispatched by the elders of the people, by the chief priests, with swords and clubs. And Judas had given them a signal. What was the signal that he told the troops to be looking for? And the one that I kiss is the one that you need to seize. And so we have this exchange. He comes and says, greetings, Rabbi, and kisses him. Other accounts even, you know, have Jesus telling him that you're betraying the Son of Man with a kiss. Jesus asks them at this time, you know, what are you doing? So that they lay hands on him. We see that someone takes a sword and strikes someone, cutting off their ear. John tells us later on that this is, in his account, that this was actually Peter, and the servant's name was Malchus. And we also learn that Jesus actually, from other accounts, actually heals this man at that time. Jesus asks them, you know, why are you doing this? I haven't done anything in secret. Everything was done publicly. Why are you coming against a robber with swords and clubs? Picking up in verse 55, I sat daily with you teaching in the temple, and you did not seize me. But all this was done that the scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled. And so they bind him and they take him away. And at this point, all of the disciples forsake him and flee. At this point, again, we're trying to get as many accounts in as we can. From the Gospel of John, we see that he is actually taken to Annas. Annas was actually the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the priest. We have to understand a little bit of background there, because when we read through John's account, it will call Annas the high priest. Well, historically, we find out that Annas was the high priest at one point and had actually been removed from power by the Romans for, guess what? Putting someone to death without their authority. And so they had removed him, but in their many people's minds, he was still the high priest. So we still see that in John, where they're referring both to Annas and to Caiaphas as the high priest. When we see this, where they're taking him one place, we're going to see in a little bit that they take him to Pilate, they take him to Herod. This was all probably in a very small, confined area. Probably did not take very long to go from one area to another, because this was all occurring right around the temple, most likely. And so he's taken before Annas. Annas has some questions for him. starts asking him about his teaching and his disciples, and Jesus is kind of appropriately short with him. I didn't do anything in secret. You can go and ask all of the people that sat and listened to me teach. I don't have any hidden agenda here. What you see is what I have been teaching. They strike him for that response. Annas then releases him to be taken to Caiaphas, and we see this trial with the Pharisees and the elders of the people all gathered together to try Jesus. They bring out false witnesses, but they were having trouble because even the false witnesses were contradicting one another. Going back, way back early in the Gospels where Jesus, they ask him his authority and he says, you know, destroy this temple and I will raise it again in 3 days. They bring this up to try and accuse him, but even those who were trying to do that were contradicting each other. Finally, Caiaphas says, okay, I'm putting you under oath. You tell us whether or not you're the Son of God. And so if we pick up in verse 64, Jesus said to him, it is as you say, nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Well, this was enough for them. They had the confession that they wanted. They convict him of blasphemy. They say that he is deserving of death. Now again, there was a problem here, and that was they could not put him to death on their own authority. They had to rely on the Romans to do this. So they take him to Pilate. Now, while this is going on, and actually John, if we look at John's account, we have the story of Peter denying Jesus actually broken up in amongst this. Matthew, Mark, and Luke put it a little bit more together. Peter has been, for what we understand from John, is one of the disciples had some type of connection with the high priest and was able to get himself and John and Peter into the courtyard. So Peter comes into the courtyard and there's a servant girl there that says, "Hey, you also were with Jesus of Galilee," but he denies it. "I do not know what you are saying." A little while longer, another girl sees him and says, "This fellow also was with Jesus of Nazareth." And he denies it with an oath. "I don't know the man." A little longer, there are others that stood by and say, "Hey, surely you're one of them. Your speech betrays you. Must have been something with the Galilean accent to give him away." It says he began to curse and swear, saying, "I do not know the man." And at that time, a rooster crowed. It says, and Peter remembered the word of Jesus who had said to him, "Before the rooster crows, you will deny me 3 times. So he went out and wept bitterly. So just as Jesus had predicted, Peter was going to deny him 3 times. Quickly, I do want to address one of the things that comes up during this study a lot, and that is Mark's account. Mark gives us a little bit more detail, and so we see that there was actually several times that the rooster crowed. And some people will look at that and say that that's a contradiction, but when we look back at how we deal with contradictions, we have to understand that he is simply giving us more detail than the other ones did. In the other accounts, he did not say, "and when a rooster crows once." He just says, "when the rooster crows." And so we can understand that they understood that that was the final rooster crowing of the night. And so there's not really a contradiction there. Mark is just simply giving us more detail about the number of times the rooster would crow. Any comments, questions about that? Kevin? Any other questions, comments on that section? Jesus is then taken to Pilate, picking up in chapter 27 of Matthew. Of course, Pilate finds himself in a difficult position. Well, let me back up just a little bit. Matthew does include for us the story of Judas here, in that Judas has seen what has happened to Jesus and says he was remorseful and brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, I have sinned by betraying innocent blood." They're not going to take this back. They basically tell him, what is that to us? You see to it. Unfortunately, and Judas decided that the solution to this was to hang himself. There have been many wonderful sermons preached about Peter's denial versus Judas's betrayal and how one was able to come back to Jesus and the other was not. This money for some reason they did not feel that they could use. They said it was blood money, so they purchased a field, what they call the field of blood, to bury strangers in. Jesus then faces Pilate. Very interesting that Pilate figures out very quickly that something's not right here. You know, I'm not finding anything that I would think would be deserving of death. First of all, it says he was amazed because they're making all of these accusations against him. And what's Jesus' response to them? Nothing. I mean, that should strike somebody as very odd, because what would be our natural tendency if we're being accused of things? We're going to defend ourselves. We're going to see if we can't talk our way out of it. We're going to see if we can't get on, you know, get on the authorities' good side here to get ourselves out of this jam. No, he's silent in the face of the accusations. Pilate asks him though, are you king of the Jews? He admits that he is. We see from John's account the further detail of this that Jesus tells him, well, you know, yes, I'm the king, but I'm not a king in the sense that you think I am. I'm not of this world. If it was, you know, we would not be having this conversation. We would be having a fight. But I'm not a king of this world. It says that Pilate, like I said, verse 18, he says, for he knew that they had handed him over because of envy. He had kind of figured out their game very quickly, and he tries to work to free him. Even to the point of saying, well, hey, you guys have got this tradition of at the feast time releasing someone. So, hey, I got this guy Barabbas that you guys might want to be released. Now, what do we know about Barabbas? Yeah. He was a genuine criminal. Well, if we piece together some of the accounts, what all was he accused of? It was murder, robbery, insurgency, rebellion, and murder. So you can see their intent of not letting Jesus go if they were going to allow this guy to be released instead of Jesus. So Pilate's little gambit here to try and release him, and you can just actually see, and I'm not letting Pilate off the hook here, but you can actually just see his, why can't I get them to let him go? It gets to the point where Pilate thinks he's going to have a riot on his hands, and he's concerned about this enough that he finally gives in to their will. Of course, we have the famous scene of him washing his hands and saying, I'm innocent of the blood of this just person. You see to it. The crowd goes so far as to even, you know, get political with him and say, you know, if you release, you're no friend of Caesar. Because he says that he's king, and we only have one king. Now, what kind of statement did they have to, well, how low did they have to go to make this? What did most Jews, how did most Jews feel about Caesar? Okay, and so, I mean, this is just incredible what they would do, what this crowd would do, if we're understanding being incited by the leaders in order to get Jesus condemned. Luke gives us a little bit more detail as well. While Jesus is being questioned by Pilate, Pilate figures out that he's from Galilee. He's like, oh, hey, Herod's in town. And so let's get Herod's opinion on this. Let's see if we can get his help. Herod was very excited about seeing Jesus. He wanted to hear him. But Jesus was not going to play this game and remain silent. And it's amazing how quickly Herod turns on him from being excited to hear him to then begin mocking him and allowing his soldiers to mock him. Finally, you know, Pilate is unable to make any headway with the crowd, and again washes his hands and delivers him to be crucified. It says that, verse 26, then he released Barabbas to them, and when he had scourged Jesus, He delivered him to be crucified. Jesus has already been struck. If we go back through, we can see that he's been struck and hit multiple times. At this point, though, the real horror begins in this Roman scourging. As we move through this, we're going to talk about this. We're going to talk about what happens with a crucifixion. And I hope we're uncomfortable. This is quite a gruesome scene. Roman scourging, a lot of people did not even survive this practice, much less crucifixion. They took some type of handle that had long leather straps on them and would tie or embed in them pieces of glass or metal, so that when that was slung, it not only impacted, but it tore and pulled the flesh and ripped the flesh. The people that had this done to them would lose quite a lot of blood when this occurred to them. So much so that we see that Jesus, if he was able to carry the cross very far at all, they had to get someone to carry it for him. After this scourging, we also see them mocking him, twisting a crown of thorns and putting it on his head, placing a reed in his hand, bowing before him and mocking him, saying, "Hail, King to the Jews." After this, they had a robe that they had put on him and took it off of him and then led him out to be crucified. Any comments or questions before we go forward with this? When we look at the idea of crucifixion, we have for us a lot of extra-biblical accounts. This was a fairly common Roman practice. But it was usually reserved for the worst criminals. Let me back up before I go forward here. They did talk about Simon from Cyrene that was asked to bear his cross. We believe from historical records, though, that this likely was not an entire cross, which would sometimes run, weigh up to about 300 pounds. Most likely, it was the top cross beam that they were had to carry. Luke records for us some women who were there mourning, and he actually tells them that it's going to be, better for those that, did not have children, and because of the time that is going to be coming. And as he's going to the cross, even predicts the fall of Jerusalem and the fall of Israel. When we look at the historical records, I put in here this quote from the Roman historian, or actually Roman lawyer, politician, Cicero. Said, "To bind a Roman citizen is a crime. To flog him is an abomination. To kill him is almost an act of murder. To crucify him is what? There is no fitting word that can possibly describe so horrible a deed." It was Cicero's opinion that Roman citizens should not even witness a crucifixion. He believed that it was so brutal. This death was, from what we understand, we haven't been able to study this because, of course, no one is going to volunteer to have this done and then have an autopsy done. We believe that it was likely due to asphyxiation because the victim had their hands then placed on those cross beams and either tied down or nailed. The nails did not typically go through the palms, which a lot of times is depicted because there's not enough strength there. Most likely through the wrists and between the ulna and radius there to give it strength so that they could hold on to that cross and pull themselves up. Because when you're in that position, you're going to sag downward. The feet were taken and turned to the side, and a nail was driven through the heels into the cross for support. In that position, you're sagging, and so you can't breathe. So the victim would have to push themselves up by their heels in order to breathe and get air in. And of course, that was quite excruciating. And over time, then, they would fatigue and then die of basically smothering. by itself, they have actually done some experiments looking at that position. And the volunteers that did this, actually, that were strapped and placed in that position, very quickly had very excruciating pain just from being in that position. So it was truly an excruciating death. Jesus's what he said immediately at the beginning of this should be very profound to us. He says, "Forgive them, for they know not what they do." The soldiers divided his garments. They did not want to divide the cloak, and so cast lots for it. The crowd is there mocking, saying, "You know, if you're the king of the Jews, come down from there. You know, he saved others, but he could not save himself." Pilate had maybe at just a little bit of a dig at them, had put the sign that said, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews," written in Hebrew and Latin and what else? Greek, I'm sorry. Hebrew, Latin, and Greek. Of course, the Jewish leaders did not like this. They said, "No, you should put there that he said he was the King of the Jews." But Pilate stood firm and said, "You know, what I've written, I have written." That Luke, all of the gospel writers talk about them, him being with the criminals, one on the right hand and on the other on the left. Luke records for us the exchange that he had between the thief initially, and you can see how this occurred, that they may not have necessarily recognized who Jesus was, because at first it seems like they were throwing accusations, hurling insults at him. I think it's clear then that at some point one of them kind of figured out what was going on and who this was. And so he actually defends or talks to the other one and says, "You know, hey, we are rightly condemned, but this man is not rightly condemned," and asks Jesus for his help. And Jesus tells him that he will be with him that day in paradise. We see another detail from the Gospel of John in which Jesus from the cross is able to see. It says the disciple whom Jesus loved, we believe that was John, and his mother standing there and asks John to take care of his mother. At the third hour, it's recorded that there is darkness. Now, if we looked at our timeline before, this is not the time of darkness. This is something that's completely abnormal. And from the third hour to the sixth hour, there was darkness. Finally, and we'll pick up in verse 46 of Matthew 27. It says, "About the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, 'Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani?' That is, 'My God, why have you forsaken me?'" Some mistakenly thought he was calling for Elijah. Others still mocking said, "You know, well, let's see if Elijah will come." We also see that Jesus then commits his spirit to God and says, "It is finished." And at that point, Jesus dies. At that point, the veil of the temple is torn from the top to the bottom, and that the earth was quaked and rocks were split. The graves were opened. It says, "And coming out of the graves after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many." All of these things were not lost on the centurion that was in charge there. Picking up in verse 54, it says, "So when the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and the things that had happened, they feared greatly, saying, 'Truly, this was the Son of God.'" It was, and we find from John, the details from John, that they did not want these men hanging on the cross during the preparation day or the next day. And so the process of crucifixion, depending upon what shape you were in or how much you had been beaten before, could last from hours to actually days before someone actually died on a cross. On top of that, it was usual that the victim was left on the cross, that they many times just to rot. because the Romans wanted to make that statement. Because there was this special religious day coming, they actually asked that they be removed, and so in order to do so, they went to break the legs. Now remember what we were saying about how you stayed alive on a cross. You had to push yourself up in order to get air. Breaking the legs then would then hasten that death. When they went to Jesus though, they found that he had already been, that he had already died. To confirm this, they pierced his side and says that water and blood came from his side. Any comments, questions about this incredible event? I think I heard the first bell. Okay. We're going to hopefully next time talk about, and we'll talk about placing him in the tomb in just a moment. We see this great event, and I hope that we ask ourselves, why? Why did this occur? Why did this have to occur? And I want you to think about between now and Sunday what the Bible tells us about why this happened. We want to talk about what atonement is, and we'll talk about theories of atonement next time. We see from the scriptures here, picking up back up in verse 62, says, on the next day, which followed the day of preparation, the chief priests and Pharisees gathered together to Pilate, saying, Sir, we remember while he was still alive how that deceiver said, after 3 days I will rise. Therefore command that the tomb be made secure until the third day, lest his disciples come by night and steal him away and say to the people, he is risen from the dead. So the last deception will be worse than the first. Pilate said to them, you have a guard, go your way, make it as secure as you know how. So they went and made the tomb secure, sealing the stone and setting the guard. Actually, I skipped ahead a little bit. We see in 57 that Joseph of Arimathea, who was a disciple of Jesus, had come and requested from Pilate from the body of Jesus, that Pilate had, of course, first marveled that he was dead, but then released the body to him. We learn from John that Nicodemus also was there with him as well. And they prepared the body the best that they could. Remember, they are coming up against this special holy day, so they're going to get Jesus in that tomb before this. It also says that the other women had seen where he was laid. And then we see from other scriptures that they prepared spices and all for when they were able to go and finish his burial preparation. Any comments or questions on that? Anything else on this? Hopefully we take some time to think, to read through this. I know I've thrown a lot. I've tried to bring in all of the different aspects of this, all of the different details. There's a lot of detail here of the things that occurred on that great day. I hope that it hits us what type of suffering this was. It was probably one of the cruelest punishments, one of the cruelest ways of dying that man has probably ever devised. Yet our Lord was willing to go through that for us, and hopefully we have two more class periods left. I want to discuss the next one about the atonement, about why this was necessary, and then hopefully we'll have time to talk about in our last class session about the resurrection. So thank you for your attention this evening.